You're listening to WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And coming up right now is Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else with the bard and Renaissance man of WCOM, Claudio. But before I let him speak, I want to let everybody else know out there, all our listeners, that Claudio is going to be the featured artist at the Cotton Company in historic Wake Forest from February 7th through March 8th of this coming year. He'll be staging recitals of his own writings along with displaying his artwork. And the Cotton Company is a place where artists can work and sell their wares as well. So, Claudio, bard and Renaissance man.
I thought you were going to call me bored there for a minute.
I thought I was going to do that, too. I slipped.
Hello to everybody out there. Glad you're tuning us in. Want to give a quick shout-out to the Carolina Theatre of Durham, the historic Carolina Theatre, who is the primary sponsor for Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else. And we actually have the... We have the pleasure and privilege of having Bob Nosek on with us today, and he's actually the vice president of the historic Carolina Theatre. We're going to get into his life and welcome him to Carolina. You can say hello anyway for the time being.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you on. We're going to dig into your life in just a few moments. I just wanted to read something very quickly that I was particularly touched by from NRDC that I'm a member of.
NRDC being?
Being the Natural Resource Defense Council, I think. I believe that's the translation. Robert Redford actually heads it, I think. He's one of the key members of it, and it's basically about defending nature.
Okay, great.
And this was just recently sent to me, and I'm going to read the letter as it was written. I know you'll be saddened as I was by an obituary written about Wolf 527, one of Yellowstone National Park's beloved wolves. She was known as 527, but she was much more than a number. She was one of the most beloved wolves in Yellowstone. I hope this tragic story will motivate you to speak out to save the hundreds of wolves in Greater Yellowstone and beyond that remain in mortal danger. Wolf 527 originated from the Druid Pack, one of the best-known wolf packs in Yellowstone's Lamar Valley, the scene of numerous National Geographic and PBS documentaries. For years, the movements of some of the members of this Yellowstone pack have been monitored by biologists and wolf watchers equipped with radio tracking devices and powerful spotting scopes. One of those wolf watchers wrote the obituary for 527, and I'm honored to share excerpts of it with you today. 527 was a wolf that marched to the beat of a very, very different drum. As a yearling, 527 left the Druids to join the Slough Pack, where she quickly became the Beta, second-in-command female. Then in 2007, she and a male wolf set off to found their own pack, the Cottonwood Creek Pack, where she became the Alpha, first-in-command female. As a leader of the Cottonwood Pack, 527 was known to be a master of survival strategies, while four other packs that inhabited the same area suffered dismal fates, her pack thrived. As her biographer recounts, she was a genius wolf in her tactics. Strategy was her game, and she was a master at it. She would return to feed her pups in the dark of night because she would not take the risk of crossing the road. But in the end, despite 527's unbelievable survival strategies, this resilient wolf was not able to outthink a rifle. It was killed on October 3rd when Montana unleashed its first public wolf hunt in modern times. Since the public hunts began, 156 wolves in the Northern Rockies have met 527's fate. And over the next year, more than 500 wolves could be shot to death by hunters and government agents, reducing the region's wolf population by a staggering 40%. And much of this is primarily being done because the rich folks out there are upset that the wolves are living on game they would rather kill. But the story doesn't have to end there, or as sadly as 527's life. If everyone who cares about wolves speaks out against this carnage now, so please take a moment to join the national outcry to save wolves. And thank you in advance for taking actions on the wolves' behalf. Together we can make sure that the death of 527 will not be in vain by winning back federal protections for the rest of Greater Yellowstone's storied wolves.
Is there a website there?
That was from Francis Beinecke. And I think the best way to, I might suggest, is just look up NRDC. And mm-hmm. that should connect you.
Okay.
But I just wanted to have that said. I have a big heart for wolves and just for nature and wildlife in general, and I think they're definitely getting the bad end of the deal and have been for way, way, way too long.
And we don't realize fully that it's all part of the ecosystem that supports us.
Absolutely.
And we've got to be a little careful about what we're doing out there.
And I'm afraid my heart does not go out to these rich hunters that would rather shoot the animals that the wild animals need to live on. Mm-hmm. That's just a pathetic notion, and the fact that we support that on any political level, it just really gives me a great disregard for our politicians.
Okay.
Anyway, having said that, now we come up for air.
Now it's more fun.
Yes, indeed. But I just thought that deserved mentioning because it just goes overlooked. And now, after that sad note, we're going to a happier one with Bob Nocek, who is the new vice president of Durham's Historical Carolina Theater, and I'm very proud to welcome him on the Speakeasy. Hello, Bob. Tell us who you are.
I've been vice president and COO of the Carolina Theater since June 8th.
Since June 8th. So actually since before you came. Or have you been here since June 8th?
June 8th, started in June.
That's when you arrived.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, that was the
first. It just seems so recent for some reason. I don't know why.
No, it's hard to believe it's 7 months now.
I know.
But it's been exciting. It's really a great place, and I absolutely love Durham.
I know Connie Campanero told me about you well before you came.
Moved down from Pennsylvania. I grew up in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and worked there my whole life, and was ready for a change. I was ready to do something different. I was ready to get back into performing arts.
You've certainly got a fascinating past that you took on outside of the performing arts.
Yeah, I certainly haven't taken a direct road to where I am by any means. I started in the newspaper business.
In what area?
I actually started part-time while I was in college as a sports correspondent in Wilkes-Barre. Really just going out and covering high school events. They had a whole staff of stringers that they would send out to cover high school games and started doing that part-time while I was in college.
All the games, or were there any of particular fascination?
It was all over the place. I mean, it was three or four a weekend. I mean, it was a time when newspapers were doing well, and they threw a lot of money at it. And so we really were committed to covering everything in the market. So I got a lot of work that way and was really only there a few months when they were starting an edition in another town nearby. Asked me to oversee sports for that edition, and I kind of did that part-time while I finished up school, and they made it a full-time job when I got out.
How long did you stay with it on the outside?
I did sports for 8 years.
With what paper, if you don't mind?
Oh, it was the Times Leader in Wilkes-Barre.
All right.
At the time, we were Cap City's ABC paper, and then we were bought by Disney, and then we became a Knight Ridder paper. And for its size, it was a really strong newspaper.
How did Disney come to find out about it? I think about Wilkes-Barre, I think it was being out of the way.
It was part of their ABC purchase.
Oh, I see.
When they bought ABC, there were a handful of newspapers in the company that ABC still owned.
I see.
And, it was actually an interesting market to be in newspapers because it was the site of the longest strike in newspaper history. And our chief competitor was a strike paper that had been formed by the striking employees in, I think, 1978, maybe.
All right.
And it was a nasty strike in a union town. And so the paper that I worked for a long time was pretty unpopular. I mean, and even when I started there, which was a good 8 or 9 years after the strike, there were still people that wouldn't have anything to do with us, that wouldn't talk to us.
Why in particular was that?
Because they were union people, and they saw our paper as the union busters.
I see.
It was really kind of a strong – it was a coal mining town. And so union ties were pretty strong. And it was really interesting to come in at the tail end of that. But one of the reasons the paper was so great was that they had been working so long to rebuild what they had lost when all the employees left and really kind of started from scratch. I mean, there were months early on where they were working out of a hotel because they couldn't get to the building because they had armed guards around the building and the striking employees were outside. And so it was kind of, it was a really fun place to be because it sort of had this almost renegade atmosphere and everybody was really dedicated. And, one of the things that amazes me, it was before I got there, but, I worked for a newspaper with a circulation probably in the 40s that sent a reporter and a photographer to China with a prep school soccer team for 2 weeks when they did a tour.
My goodness, 40s? Is that what you said?
Pardon?
You said circulation in the
40s? Yeah, 40s. And they sent a reporter and a photographer to China.
My God.
Nothing was off limits. We had a traveling writer and would send a photographer with our minor league baseball team. It was about as aggressive as a mid-sized paper could be.
That's extraordinary. I mean, because basically all that could have been on any economic level would be a write-off.
Yeah.
A tax write-off.
Yep. And they were committed to being aggressive and really making an impact. And so over the years, they continued to build circulation up. And so it was a fun place to be. So I did sports for the first 8 years.
How well did it,
just
to stay on that particular frame, how well did it build itself up?
They became the circulation leader, really starting from zero. I mean, they had pretty much lost everything at the
time
of the strike.
Which went to about what kind of volume?
We got to when they launched the Sunday paper, I think they got into the 60s, and then we're probably up into the 50s while competing with another paper that was still doing 30 to 40,000 circulation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But they had been the dominant paper in the market before the strike, so.
What's the population in that area?
The entire market area is about 650,000. It's Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, Hazleton.
Gotcha.
And it's fairly similar to the Raleigh-Durham market. And it's interesting to me to see some of the advertising challenges we face having come from a split market where you've got newspapers that are focused either in Scranton or in Wilkes-Barre.
Right.
And, you know, even your radio and TV kind of leans one way or another. And it can be a little challenging up there to sort of hit the whole market when you're trying to get a message out.
No doubt.
And I think it prepared me well to be here where, you know, we sort of face that challenge.
I was just connecting the
basis.
Dots on that. I can kind of see why Connie had you in mind for this. Mm-hmm. So I assume that you're assisting in that area at this point.
Yeah, I oversee the marketing department. So, you know, Aaron, our director of marketing, and I work pretty closely together, and we're constantly talking about that struggle and, you know, how do we get the message out to a broader area and not just focus on Durham. And
Well, we've got Chapel Hill and Carrboro here and anyone listening on the World Wide Web. So
yep. Stayed at the newspaper for 12 years. The last 4 years that I was there, I started doing some arts and entertainment coverage. And
for that newspaper?
Yep. And
what slipped you into that?
It was always an interest. My mother was a music teacher. I kind of grew up with the arts and, you know, grew up going to Broadway shows. And so started covering a lot of local entertainment, advancing shows, interviewing celebrities that were going to be in town, reviewing. And I was fortunate enough that they gave me latitude to go out and start doing some Broadway reviews.
All right.
It wasn't assigned to me, and it certainly was last on the list of priorities, but they let me do it on my own time and published them. And so that certainly was a lot
of
fun. So
what'd you do, just slip in with a pass?
I actually got into two of the reviewers' organizations, Outer Critics Circle and Drama Desk. And once you're in those, then you're basically invited to the press.
It's an open door then. That's good. Yeah, I was wondering if you were doing some detective type work to get yourself in the certain doorways.
No, I mean, in the beginning, it was just making calls to the press reps and most of the time they were accommodating.
Gotcha.
But so, you know, I did that. I actually covered the opening of the arena in Wilkes-Barre while I was on the arts and entertainment side.
Explain arena.
The county actually got behind an effort to build a 9,000-seat hockey arena.
Ah, okay.
They got an agreement to get Pittsburgh's top minor league team in town. So the building opened in 1999. I covered the opening, wrote extensively about it, got to know a lot of the staff there. I was really pretty well connected in the arts and entertainment community up there and was interested in moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
After 12 years of writing on deadline, that kind of takes a toll. I was interested in trying something else. So, you know, just through the course of getting to know people and having conversations, there was an opportunity to go to the FM Kirby Center, which was an 1,800-seat historic theater in Wilkes-Barre that had been restored in the mid-'80s. Okay. And they were looking for someone to do programming, and the executive director, she had listened to me suggest artists for a long time. Every time we talked, I had people in mind that they should have been bringing, and you know, so one day the opportunity came up, and I made the leap and got into this business.
That's an interesting leap.
Yeah, yeah.
When you say this business,
entertainment arts.
Okay.
It was kind of learning on the job. I was there for 3.5 years and went from never having booked a show to booking a full season, you know, probably 30 to 40 shows a year, you know, making the connections with agents and trying to figure out what worked and what didn't work in the market. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing there was I had grown up in the market, so I had a pretty good sense of what would fly.
Definitely an advantage, yeah.
Yeah. But I loved it. It's
So how did you and Connie connect?
I actually...
Connie Campanaro, by the way, folks, that is the president of Carolina Theatre in Durham.
I didn't know Connie before this job. I just happened to see the job listed. I hadn't really been looking, but, you know, my partner Matt and I were interested in getting out of the Northeast. We were kind of tired of the winter.
Getting a little cold out
there. We like to travel a lot, and we would usually do a couple weeks in the South somewhere in the winter, and... we're really having the conversation about trying something different. And so I was just keeping an eye on what was out there in the South. And I really didn't know Durham at all. It wasn't an area that I was looking at specifically. I wasn't really familiar with anything here, but just happened to see the vice president job posted. It had been listed on some national sites like
League of Historic
American Theaters.
Interesting. I actually remember when Connie first put that into motion, yeah.
And I saw it out there and applied for it, and it was really at that point that Connie and I started having conversations. We did a few phone calls, eventually came down, spent some time with her, interviewed with some board members, and and she called me maybe a few weeks after that to offer me the job. And by that point, I had spent a lot of time looking into this whole area and just really fell in love with what I saw here. You know, I loved the arts and entertainment opportunities. Mm-hmm. I loved that. The people I had met when I was down here just were very welcoming, and it felt like a place that could become home pretty quickly.
The area has always had a strong, even when I came here in the 70s, it's had a strong feeling of the arts, even though primarily back in those days a lot of it was underground, but you could see it making an emergence, and it's rich with that kind of
capacity. It really is. And that's a part of what I liked about it was that it had all of those opportunities, but that on many levels it still felt like a small town.
Right.
It was manageable.
That is the beauty.
I wasn't making the leap from, from Wilkes-Barre to moving to Manhattan and having to adjust with everything that came there. I mean, I love New York, but I don't know about living there. But Durham, especially downtown, just really felt like...
I gave New York a year, and that was enough for me as far as the city goes. Now, upstate is gorgeous.
Yeah. So, I just loved everything I saw here. Mm-hmm. And so when I was offered the job, it really, it didn't even take a night to think about it. It was, it was a done deal for me that day.
It also has the feel of a place that's still growing, so you can be part of something instead of something that's already set in stone.
Yep. And for me, the sense of growth was important because, Wilkes-Barre's been struggling for a long time. The whole coal region has. And there have been some great efforts to kind of revitalize Wilkes-Barre's downtown, but it's slow and it's painful.
What has it gone to since coal is no longer a thriving enterprise?
It really hasn't found one industry to take over. It kind of became a big manufacturing center for a while, but that's phased out. A lot of the jobs have gone overseas, and so plants have shut down, and so now even the industrial parks that once were pretty busy have a lot of empty buildings.
I think the Bush era cleared up a lot of those towns.
So it's kind of struggling to find its way, and I still have a lot of friends there, but it's. Being back for the holidays sort of reminded me of just how difficult it can be in the Northeast in some of these older cities that haven't really progressed and found what their new identity is.
And I suppose most people on average that live there or that live out their lives there are people that are just deeply rooted in the community and have some sort of traditional work that's going to see them through their old age and very little new happening.
That really is it. And, I think for what was interesting to me was we had other friends who at some point had moved away and come back. And, we had one couple that we're very close with had moved to Arizona for a few years.
There's a switch.
And they ended up coming back. I think ultimately the people who come back, we have friends who spent some time in Philadelphia and came back. I find that the ones who come back to Wilkes-Barre usually do it because of family. They usually do it because they find it harder than they anticipated to be away from family, especially as parents are getting older. And
so it's not necessarily so much the geography as it is the emotional connection.
That seems to be the overriding factor. It's close enough that I can go up pretty regularly and get time. I mean, I've got a young niece and nephew that I like to spend time with, and. So I try to get up when I can, but, I just don't have the same pull to be back. I love it here so much that, I from day one just felt like it was home and was really thrilled to be here.
So me tapping the mic. So that's how in my many travels, That's how I've always been able to establish whether I was going to spend some time in a place when you just sort of pop up there and the first vibe that you get is that, yeah, I'm meant to be here.
And, you know, going home and experiencing the cold and the snow, yes. It's kind of nice to get back here.
I've never so much minded the cold if I loved the geography, but I did spend a week visiting a very dear friend in Villanova, Philadelphia, that I told you about, and that 15 below with a wind that was about 45 miles an hour really sort of got you. Even though I was born in Germany, but went from Germany to Africa, so I went to the tropics pretty quick.
Although I've been told here that I'll kind of settle into it and get used to it, and that the winters here will start to feel cold to me at some point.
Oh, once the blood thins, yes. Yeah. So what is your cultural background? Is it the name Nosek? I'm assuming that's Polish.
Yep. Yeah, my father's parents actually came from Poland in their 20s. And
so would it actually be Nosek or Nosek?
It was actually more of like a CZ pronunciation. It was more of Nutsack, actually.
Okay.
And
so I was going to say, having a boss by the name of Nosek, that's worse than checks in the mail.
Everybody always asked my father what it was before they shortened it, but they didn't. That's just always what it was. And I've actually figured out, I can't read the websites because they're in Polish. My dad might be able to read them, but apparently there's a Nosek bat, too, that gets written about a lot in Poland.
Huh.
My dad grew up where in a household where they primarily spoke Polish.
Mm-hmm. I have ancestry in Poland as well as Russia.
And his dad worked in the coal mines. And so it was kind of at that time it was kind of a traditional northeastern Pennsylvania family was, mm-hmm. Immigrant parents, sure. Coal miner father. And, my father grew up on the tail end of the Depression and that sort of shaped his outlook on things. And
I can imagine the conservatism.
Yeah. And that's kind of where I come from. My mother was Irish, and my mother's loyalty is to the Irish side, but her father also had, I think, some English in him, and it's a little more mixed on that
I can
side.
Just see the spark of tempers when things got down.
Yep.
I've never seen an Irish person argue friendly. Not when it got serious.
Oh, they always argue friendly.
Yes, right. Charmingly for the most part, until the doors close, then. What? So, welcome to North Carolina.
Thanks. Really,
what are
really
some of your aspirations with the theater ahead of you?
I'm a technology guy.
Good.
And the theater isn't
finally somebody can relate to backstage.
Yep, the theater isn't really oriented in that direction. I've been working in buildings for a long time where we had barcode scanners at the doors to scan tickets.
Uh-huh. Right. Of course, the big yeah. I can
you
see
know,
that.
Where. I was always, kind of out on the cutting edge of technology and bringing those things into my buildings. And so that's a priority for me over the next few years, mm-hmm. is to sort of upgrade the technology we're using, look at the tools we're using to manage our relationships with our customers. And, that's a big priority for me over the
I
next few
imagine,
years.
Yeah.
But it's expensive, which is part of the problem because,
right.
The Carolina Theater is not sitting in a pile of money. We're a nonprofit.
No.
And with most, we're actually doing better than most arts organizations these days.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Some of the organizations in the Triangle that I've read about have really had to make serious cuts in mm-hmm. either the types of programming they offer or in terms of staff and we've weathered the storm pretty well, and we're optimistic about the next few months in our season. We've actually just locked up some shows that we'll be announcing in the next few weeks.
Good.
The challenge is going to be finding ways to integrate some of these things that I want to do without having a lot of capital money up front to pay for it.
So how are we advantaged? And I say we because to me, I actually helped open the doors there. I was the first stage technician ever hired by Paul Gabriel, who was one of my best friends. And I've always felt a kinship with the place. It's always been a part-time work for me, but... It's never ending. Whenever I'm in the area, I go back there. So I say we. How does that advantage us for the fact that we're owned by the city?
There may be a point down the road at which, when we're looking at an expense like that, we could possibly talk to the city and make it something that they own. I mean, they're mm-hmm. responsible for the capital improvements
right.
in the building. But, I tend to look more towards – trying to find new revenue streams.
Private funding type situations.
Because we have a long wish list for the city, and we submit that every year.
Well, we just had the audio stuff replaced last year.
Yeah, and we're starting to have conversations with the city about what's going to be next and prioritizing some of the work that could be done over the next few years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'd love to see a new sound system for our live events, because right now we have to go out and rent a sound system every time we bring in a concert act. And that's a significant expense. And to eliminate that over 3 or 4 years would save us quite a bit of money. So, you know, we're trying to weigh the value of those things. The city has specific needs they need to address just in terms of accessibility. You know, there are some ADA requirements that still need to be met in the building. We're looking at maybe having to move some seats around in cinema to create wheelchair positions.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And, you know, so, you know, but we've also talked about possibly getting new carpeting. We've got some spots that really can't be cleaned anymore. And so there's a list, a couple $1 million long.
I was going to say that in itself would be a major undertaking, the carpeting, because I mean, I like the old carpet. I actually have a piece of it when they first put it down. But God.
And obviously the plaster in Fletcher Hall too.
Yes.
You know, we've got some damage that's stabilized, but over the years before the ceiling was replaced, there was water getting into the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of that plaster, you know, anybody who's been to the Carolina Theater, I'm sure, has noticed it, that there are those white spots and
certain areas.
You can kind of see where it's crumbled and it's dried out now. And you know, we're talking to the city too about what they can possibly do to restore that, which would also be a major project and might require us to close for a while if they're going to need scaffolding to work on that. So
I think the expense of that will also be the fact that you have to bring in specialists for that kind of gold leafing and so on.
Yep. So we're constantly talking to the city about these things, and we've got a list, and there are some cinema upgrades we'd like to do. We'd love to get new sound in cinema, because we realize that the experience people have right now isn't necessarily the same as going to a brand new theater, commercial cinema.
Right.
So we'd like to upgrade that experience.
Although I do have to say that just having communicated with the public at large that comes to these events, including the film festivals and so on, one of the things that people like about the Carolina Theater as it stands now is the fact that it's those little romantic imperfections.
Yeah.
I think that is part of the charm.
Yeah. It's got character.
Yes, it does.
And, you know, that's one of the things especially Fletcher Hall, one of the things that I love the most about historic theaters is just, you know, standing in the space and looking around and you can feel what's gone on in there over the years.
Oh, yeah. First time I ever walked in when my friend invited me to come be part of it, we were still building the stage. And the fly rail and the whole thing. I was part of all that. But I remember walking in and just seeing the three balcony levels and Fletcher Hall, and it felt like being on board an old ship.
Yep.
And I just kind of looked at it and said, yeah, I need to be here for a while.
Yep.
And it does have that feel.
Yeah. One of the challenges we face that's kind of new to me coming from Wilkes-Barre was the fact that the history of the theater wasn't always positive for everyone.
No.
You know, and I was kind of stunned. You know, I knew the theater had been segregated, but the point at which I learned that it was 1963 when it finally changed was kind of shocking to me to think that it
a wall
been,
of
had
shame on
recently.
The balcony.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you know, so that's sort of been it's really been a fascinating learning experience for me coming in and you know, sort of working through some of the cultural issues that we face in Durham that we didn't face in Wilkes-Barre. We had a 1% African American population in Wilkes-Barre.
That was it.
Yep. And so, you know, and I think that was one of the concerns for Connie and the board was, you know, is Bob going to be ready for sort of the racial balance of
Durham?
Well,
actually, it's predominantly more African-American.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, one of the remarkable things to me is just how positive I've seen that be in Durham.
I agree with
and
that.
I'm, you know, I don't have my head in the sand. I know there are struggles and difficulties out there and that not everyone is satisfied. But
there was a time that Durham actually had the nickname of being the Detroit of the South.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it lived up to it for a while, although I'm feeling a good leveling at this point.
Yeah. But I love to be in a place where, you know, it seems to me that people are so open-minded and progressive you know, that a lot of the difficulties that go on in other cities aren't playing out in Durham, that people have kind of come to accept, you know, accept the way it is. And
I get that impression as well, yeah, because I've been through some of those phases. I used to be head of security out there as well, and there were times we actually had to get people out.
Yeah.
But I really have sensed a leveling, and it's almost like the the Carolina Theater on its own, and it has its own ghosts anyway, but that it's created this place for people to come and just sort of take on the consciousness of those four walls somehow. Yeah. And it's because I haven't sensed anything that would suggest to me that Durham is still a violent place.
Yeah.
From the type of people you meet at the Carolina Theater.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't see it.
No, I'm very pleased to say that. Yeah. I agree. Now, I've seen you walking around there with a camera a number of times, and photography is one of my passions, and I was just wanting to dig into that a little bit. What's your bent with the camera?
I'd consider myself, I guess, a semi-pro. I get paid to take pictures once in a while, which is always a thrill, but mostly I just shoot because I love it. You know, I think it goes back to... I think it really goes back to my time at the newspaper. Obviously,
I can see that. Did you shoot your own at the paper?
Once in a while, but more than that, I spent a lot of time with photographers.
All right, yeah.
And especially when I was in our bureau in Hazleton, I had a photographer there, Pete Wilcox, and he and I got to be really good friends. And, you know, so we would talk about equipment, and we would if we were going to do a studio portrait shot of somebody to accompany a feature, I was involved in the process of talking about what my ideas were. And so I started thinking about photography from an artistic standpoint. And but I kind of had minimal technical knowledge at that point. And on a newspaper salary, I didn't have a lot of money for equipment or for processing.
Especially cameras.
Yeah. Yeah. So I never really got too serious about it. I mean, I owned 35mm equipment, and I would take pictures on vacation. Always enjoyed taking nature photographs and wildlife. And
so did I.
So would do that from time to time, but it really wasn't until digital kind of spread that – It was affordable to get into it.
Mm-hmm. I haven't actually spilled over to digital yet. I've still got my Nikon 72mm lens. Started out with a Pentax K1000, which was a great little camera. You could buy for $100. It was the only camera you could buy that was 35mm that you could buy for that. But one of these days I'll have to educate myself on the whole new medium that we have now. God knows.
Oh, the digital is great. Absolutely I'm sure. Great. Yep. You just take this little card thing and stick it in your printer, and there you've got it on the computer, and you don't have to pay anybody.
Yes, I know. It's incredible.
Beautiful. It's interesting to me, though, that I find myself trying to almost work myself backwards from what digital will allow me to do, because it's nothing for me, to go out and shoot and sort of keep the camera on a rapid mode and just hold the shutter down and grab 20 shots of a scene, especially if it's an action, if I'm shooting a wedding or something with some action.
Something in motion. Yeah.
And, the problem is I'll walk out of there with 1,000 frames from the course of a day and have to cut that down. And so I've now sort of purposely tried to get myself back to being more selective and maybe not shooting on the rapid fire and looking for the frame or two that I want to get. And
it's not going to be the expense to you that it used to be.
Yep.
And you can just delete what you don't want. So I really don't see that you have much concern there.
No, I think the concern is that I don't want my eye to get lazy.
I see.
Don't want the equipment to be the one collecting the photographs and then I find them later. I want to.
You don't
want to
be the human tripod.
Yeah. Yep.
Right.
In terms of what I do with it now, I really shoot a little bit of everything. I still enjoy doing nature and wildlife. I spent some time out at Yellowstone 2 years ago. And I've actually – probably my favorite place in the country is Everglades National Park.
Where is that?
It's just outside of Miami. It's kind of the whole southwestern
Everglades. I was thinking
corner
Florida,
of,
yeah.
Yep. It's kind of the southwestern corner of the bottom of Florida. It's about as far south as you can go.
I used to live in Fort Lauderdale.
Okay.
On the yachts and schooners I worked on.
And the diversity of wildlife there is just incredible, and especially to go in the winter during the migration season when the birds are there and to get out and shoot alligators. And it really is like being in another land. The terrain is different than anything you'll see anywhere in the country.
That's for sure.
And so I've shot there a lot. I've been to quite a few of the national parks. But as I've gotten more serious about photography, I've started doing some weddings. Mm-hmm. I actually been working for a studio in Wilkes-Barre, as a second shooter for some weddings. They had hired me a number of times.
I've done some of those myself.
And I've gotten some work from friends. But the thing that I'm kind of more fascinated with now is studio lighting and portraiture. And I think the thing that I love the most about photography is that there's always something more to learn.
Mm-hmm.
It's really more the learning that intrigues me the most. I actually just spent some time in New York in November on the Digital Landscape Workshop series. It's a
where was that held?
It's most of the shooting we did in Manhattan. But it's there's four photographers who run this, and they do a number of them throughout the country, and they tend to do national parks. But in terms of photographers, they're fairly big names. It's Moose Peterson, who's one of the top wildlife photographers in the country. Joe McNally, who's probably the top lighting guy in the country and a shot for National Geographic forever. And then Laurie Excel, who's really a great wildlife photographer and does a lot of her own tours. And Kevin Dobler, who also assists, and he does some nature photography. And so there were 30 of us who spent four days with them. And they had we had a combination of location shoots. They took us out for a sunset overlooking Manhattan from the cliffs in New Jersey, and took us to the Statue of Liberty at sunrise. And in between, we had some classroom time. It was, you know, it was really a neat opportunity to learn from people who
were
working
at the
professional level. It was 4 days.
Okay.
And it was neat because Joe's a New York guy. And typically they do these out in national parks and their wildlife. They do a lot. They do annual ones in Maine shooting lighthouses. And this was kind of Joe's New York. And so we were in Times Square for a while, and it was just it was really a great opportunity. But I'm constantly looking for workshops because I want to learn from other people, and I want to, you know, it's. Sometimes it's about direct learning. Sometimes it's picking up information. Other times it's just being motivated by a new environment or seeing what someone else does. And,
right.
I'm fascinated by it. And I also tend to get caught up in equipment a little bit, and it's become a very expensive hobby. And,
yes.
I'd be interested in knowing you print. What do you use to print your photos out?
I actually have a. It's the Epson, I think it's a 1400. It can print up to 13 by 19. But it's not a particularly expensive printer. I mean, it's maybe $300.
Okay.
And what do you use as far as actual stock?
I've been using Epson papers. Usually they're higher end papers. Currently, I've been doing a lot of matte printing. I used to do glossy, but I actually like the results I'm getting out of the matte.
I prefer matte myself.
But I'll send things out too. I'll use MPix or some of the other national printers, and every once in a while we'll send things out. I'm actually lately kind of focused on printing a little bit, and you know, I think I was realizing that I've got some things on my website and people see them there, but that I didn't have a lot around me, and so I've been doing some prints lately, and even just brought a few into my office at work. And
that's one of the things when I found and you know, be so excited about being able to do digital photography and get it on your computer and everything, and then printing it out on a regular printer, because I've just got the CX 4800, it loses.
I imagine
vibrancy.
It does, yeah, unless you have
and
what
I'm
they put together.
I'm thinking, like, okay, that's why they say you need a, you know, a special printer to get the colors.
One of the things that I've really had to work to learn is the whole color profiling and you know, color management is a whole science to it, and, you know, making sure you're using the right profile for the paper that you're using, and, you know, so that's been another area where I've really had to study and learn. And a lot of it I've just picked up online. I just read the forums and read other people's blogs and look at what other photographers are doing and try to learn from them that way.
Just to remind everybody, you're listening to Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else on WCOM 103.5 FM. I'm here in the studio with Audrey Layden, my co-host, and she's also the host of Carborough BookBeat. And we have the pleasure of having Bob Nosek, who is the recent vice president of the Historic Carolina Theater in downtown Durham. So look up anything that's coming up there. It's always worth your while. Back to Bob in the studio.
Thanks.
So we've just covered your photography.
Yes.
I've actually seen some of the shots you've taken. I think one is a postcard thing that we got for Christmas with Connie on stage, and you took the shot from behind her, just covering the entire Fletcher Hall, which I thought was really beautifully done.
Yeah,
how long did you have your shutter open for that scene?
I was handheld, so it wasn't very long. I don't remember specifically. Not bad at all.
My favorite thing in photography in general is natural light photography. Yeah. That's my passion.
Yeah, in the course of shooting weddings, I've started doing a lot of flash work. And I actually don't think I like it as much. I'm starting to gravitate back towards
natural light. I have one of the features that I have on my lens. The reason I bought it was it's got the 4/1000th of a second stop thing, so you can. There's really very little you can't capture with that. I once had a dog of mine who was half shepherd and half Irish setter and looked like a golden retriever coming full force out of a little lake and just sort of shaking himself free before making the run towards me, and I took a shot of that and froze every drop. It was gorgeous.
That's nice. Beautiful. Yeah. When I look at the wedding work I've done with flash versus the natural light, I feel like the natural light shots are the ones that are the keepers to me. They're the ones that down the road
they give you the colors and hues.
And there's usually a grain to them, which I like.
Yes.
Because I'm shooting at a higher ISO, and I find myself sort of thinking, the flash is a nice tool because it lights up any space, but I find myself being drawn now to natural light a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for some reason my passion has pretty much stayed there. Just looking outside, are we blocking a truck? We noticed the truck pulling in. I don't know if he's backing back out again.
They're backing into Weaver Street Market.
Oh, that's what that is. Okay. Yeah, they're all the way up to the radio station. But either there's a takeover happening or it's the Obama administration coming in for a look. This is what kind of radio station you got here?
A good one.
Yes, indeed.
A good one.
One where you do not get corporate speak. You actually get freedom of speech.
Speakeasy.
Indeed. That's the idea. The double entendre. Speakeasy. The double entendre there being speak like you'd speak in a pub. Anyway, back to you.
Do you ever print any of your stuff out on canvas? Because I've seen that done, and it really amazed me. You get something that really looks fantastic when it's printed out on canvas.
I haven't lately. I actually had tried one early on, and I wasn't completely thrilled with the results.
Okay.
But it's one of those things I've looked at. One of the things that I'm really interested too is there are companies now that are starting to print on sheet metal. And it's expensive, and I don't think I'd want to do it often, but I think I've thought about it for some of the New York shots because of just the nature of the light
How practical is that going to be though for the market?
It's something I would just do for myself.
Yeah, I could see that.
It's really something I would do that if I, for my own wall, if I really like the look.
I've never actually heard of this. It's quite surprising.
I had actually seen it. The studio that I used to work for in Wilkes-Barre had actually done it with one of their senior pictures.
So what's it? How is it projected and absorbed that way?
I honestly don't have any idea. I don't know if it's like a laser etching process. I don't know how they do it. But it's kind of a neat result in the end.
Now, quick question, is there a link to any of your work? Do you have any up anywhere?
Yeah, actually, I have a website at bobnosek.com.
Oh, good.
And I've got a blog that I really have a hard time finding time to keep current. but I tend to update after any trips or, a lot of the work that I've done is up there. So.
Okay, good.
Nosek is N-O-C-E-K?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yep.
BobNosek.com. Yeah, I'll remember that myself. I want to see some of this stuff. So what is what's up ahead? What are you anxious about with the Carolina Theater?
The January is a busy month for two reasons. The first is that, we've got a lot of shows. We've got Chris Bode for two nights. We've got the Four Bitchin' Babes.
And Chris always does well.
We've got Stephen Wright coming back, and he's really doing well.
I stage managed him
too.
A couple of years ago. He's great fun,
And, so we've got quite a few shows coming up in the next few months. But then the other exciting thing is that Connie and I will really start working on next season. We're headed to New York late next week. The National Arts Presenters Booking Conference is really where we'll start talking to agents about what's available for 2010, 2011.
That, to me, would be one of the absolute fun parts of being vice president, though, being in that capacity.
It really is. And honestly, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to come back to performing arts. Mm-hmm. When I was at the Kirby Center, I had done the booking exclusively for 3.5 years. And at Wachovia Arena, we didn't really have that opportunity.
More indirect when you did it there, or was it hands-on?
It was at the arena, we really didn't promote ourselves. We had promoters who rented the building.
Okay.
We were a county-owned facility, but we weren't permitted to take risk.
Mm-hmm.
So there always had to be a promoter renting the building, which meant there was no real opportunity to sort of choose what you had.
And no mingling of sorts. Like you get to meet the artist or at least a strong rep.
Yeah, it was a business, and we were, at a distance from a lot of it.
Whereas now you're hands-on.
Yeah, and the opportunity to be in a place where I could actually, be involved in helping to curate a season and sort of put forward what the image of the theater is through the artists we present was what drew me to back to the performing arts. So it's exciting now to, to be headed off to the conference again and starting to see what's out there and You know, it's a lot of fun. It's shopping. It's
No doubt.
You know, it's going up and down the aisles and talking to people and you know, and just seeing what's going to be out there and bringing it all back and saying, okay, what fits, what doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would we love to do but can't afford? And if we can't afford it, is there an opportunity to be able to by negotiating a price down?
Right.
Or
and in some cases, I've found, having been around artists much of my life, that there often is a loophole as long as you ask for it.
Well, that's the thing is nobody, you know, there's a quote, but nothing has a fixed price tag.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what we'll find from time to time is that an artist will be playing in Charlotte and they don't have anything up against that. And so then they're looking for something in driving distance.
And there's also the historical element of the Carolina Theater and the legends that have performed there. Sometimes people just want that in their portfolio.
Yep. Yeah.
So that,
yeah,
that's what I was thinking of. Yeah. The pull of the theater itself as being something that would attract people.
I've got it on my portfolio, so.
Yeah. We have a number of artists that just absolutely love the theater.
Absolutely.
Chris Bode's one that's been back a number of times and, you know, and just really loves the space.
And I know I spoke to Stephen Wright when he was here last. He loves the space. And I've spoken to many an artist that I've stage managed there because that's the thing I do frequently. And 9 times out of 10, the reason they're back is that they just love it there.
Yeah. Our David Cross date in October, which sold out for us and was a fantastic night, that was actually a case where he really wanted to play somewhere in the Triangle.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted a date in Raleigh or Durham. And so, you know, his agent was talking to Connie for a while. You know, we were finally able to find a date that worked. But it was, you know, it's one of those markets where we're on everybody's radar. And, you know,
that. They
may not always end up at the Carolina Theater, but it's a market where especially intelligent artists want to play.
Right.
And so we benefit from that from time to time.
I think so. And I think there's also the added advantage being that kind of a house and the historical aspect of it to where if occasionally you ask somebody to bring their price down, if you sort of loop that into the fact that the Carolina Theater is doing a fundraiser and would appreciate support, I can see them being more prideful in bringing the price down for that kind of support. You're giving them something else to use to explain why they're dropping the rates.
We actually were able to do that with our piano fundraiser in September.
Good.
The Irving Berlin Show, I Love
yes,
the Piano,
yes,
that we
yes.
presented. That was a situation where Connie just happened to see something about the show, either a flyer or something from the agent.
Mm-hmm.
And her first thought was, you know, we really do need a piano because it's another one of those expenses
Absolutely.
That we incur whenever we have to rent one. And just sort of on a whim approached the agent and said, hey, you know, would you be willing to do the show for maybe a reduced fee or some sort of special arrangement where we could try to do a fundraiser in conjunction with it? And they were really flexible and they worked with us.
Great idea. How do
know,
we stand on that, by the way?
We're around $10,000 between ticket sales and the revenue that was donated. The really nice thing about it was it created awareness.
Absolutely.
It started people thinking about the fact that we don't have a piano. And so we got a number of contributions related to the show.
Wonderful.
And, you know, so we're probably a third of the way there. We've kind of roughly looked at $30,000 as the number we'd like to get to.
We're looking for a baby grand, of course.
Yeah, we would need to buy. We'd be really sensitive to what the artists are going to use. It would be a waste for us to buy a piano that wasn't up to the quality that artists would use. And if they came in and said, I wouldn't play on that, then we'd still be renting.
Yeah.
So, you know, we really want to make sure that, you know, it's kind of the sum of all the artist riders that we've received over the years
and
that it's going to be a good quality piano. And, you know, the other thing we're hoping along the way is that the awareness that we need one may generate an opportunity from someone who has one, who's looking to sell or looking to donate. Donate would always be
I know some people that
fantastic.
Have half a dozen, but they don't want to let any go.
A donated piano would be fantastic.
Yes.
We really just, you know, it was one of those opportunities where the show was a perfect fit for what we needed to do.
Yes.
And so now we're looking down the road and thinking, you know, what other artists can we work with to do this? And maybe once a year for 3 years, we try to raise $10,000. And then at the end of the 3 years, we've got our 30. And
I know we had Arlo Guthrie there last year,
yeah.
and he liked the place. I took care of the hospitality end of that and some stage managing. So I know he was very happy to be there and had the same historical feeling about the place. So who knows what you can ask there.
What I love about the artist experience is that a lot of times in historic theaters, what the artist experiences backstage isn't the ideal, because in most historic theaters there's cramped dressing rooms, they're old, they're, you know, they're buried under the stage,
and
or
sometimes not the right people are picked to host these people.
Yeah. But it, you know, I'm thinking specifically in terms of the building that it's just fantastic that we've got these brand new dressing rooms and we've got more space than most historic theaters have because of the work that was done in the 90s under the cinemas. And so I love that we're able to combine sort of the historic environment, but really give them kind of a newer experience.
A couple of years ago, Connie surprised me for my birthday, and I don't even really know if she realized it was my birthday. It was actually March 10th. My birthday was the 11th. But they called me and they asked me if I'd be willing to come in at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I said, why on earth at 2 o'clock in the morning unless we're prepping for a show that starts at 5 or 6? And she said, no, that there'd apparently been some discontent with George Winston, who came a couple of years before, and I don't know if he'd be had crosswords with whoever was hosting him or what the deal was. I have no idea. But that he was coming in, and he basically – they just wanted somebody there to secure the building because he wanted the place to himself from 2 to 4 in the morning so he could just play to an empty theater. And him and I connected like old buddies that used to hitchhike through Europe. We sat on that stage cross-legged for about 2 hours until I said, okay, you better go up and play that piano. So I checked the building and I sat down and I had a one-man concert to myself, which was incredible.
It's great. It's a great experience. Yeah. And those are the kind of things that rarely happen in the arena business, and that's why I'm back in performing arts.
Yes, I can fully appreciate the whole intimacy of it.
Yeah.
And I had the pleasure of some years ago performing on that stage with the North Carolina Symphony. I'm usually a voice that they bring in as a narrator, and they did Igor Stravinsky's Histoire du Soldat, The Soldier's Tale. So I got to do five voices and go nuts on stage, and they had a pantomime who had actually learned under Marcel Marceau, who happens to be was a very dear friend of mine. And so it was a wonderful time on stage. Got to go crazy, and then we got a standing ovation.
That's fantastic.
That's why my picture's on the wall, by the way.
Okay. The thing that I'd love to experience is to actually have someone come in and do an acoustic performance without any amplification, because that's the way these theaters were designed.
And there is such an ambiance in there.
Yeah, it's. I just think that would be a great experience if we could find the right artist who was willing to do it. But these days, it's tough to find anybody who would be willing to take
brave
that chance
enough.
Because everyone is so amplified.
Maybe Joan Baez.
Maybe
she's been there
Maybe.
A number of times. I don't know why that just came to mind, because she certainly got a voice that could bounce off those walls.
I also wonder, though, if I'm one of the few people who would appreciate it, because I know even when artists are amplified, you still get people who complain that they couldn't hear, or it wasn't like listening to the CD at home, which it never is. But that's the great thing about a live performance, is that it is a different experience, and there's only one way to get it.
There was a situation by a German guitarist by the name of Freddie Quinn. He was a sort of a folk vocalist, and he was on stage with all sorts of other performers that were doing a big benefit. And most of these people, people's voices depended greatly on things that could be done on the soundboard. And what happened is during the performance, the power went out. So none of these other singers could sing anymore, and Freddie came up and did a solo anyway and got a standing ovation. So true voices really carry.
Yep.
I think that's ultimately what you're trying to say. Are we coming close to a wrap, Audrey?
Well, we've got a few more minutes. We can talk about the future of the Carolina Theater. Where do you want it to be 5 years from now?
You know, it's an exciting time the way I see it, because I feel like the entertainment business is correcting itself now.
Somehow, yes.
It got too big for a while.
It's becoming a little more humble.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that might not even – I think that is a descriptive, but it's reinventing itself to be more on an earth level.
Yeah. I think the there was major growth when you go back 5-10 years.
No doubt.
You know, just talking in terms of the concert business, which obviously isn't the only thing we do. I mean, we're really dedicated to our arts programming as well.
Mm-hmm.
But on the concert side, you look at the sort of the consolidation of the industry over the years, with Live Nation buying up all the regional promoters and artist guarantees getting to the point where 1,000-seat venues couldn't afford artists anymore.
Right.
I think the combination of just sort of a self-correction to that business and the economic forces, you're starting to see it come back down a little bit. And artists, you know, artists who 5 years ago might have wanted $50,000 are now starting to think about $25,000 and are willing to play in 1,000 seats and not believing that they need to be playing, you know, $7,500 to $10,000 every night. And
sad to think, because that artists would think on such grand scales, because it's really the more intimate audiences that get your name around.
Yeah.
That's where word of mouth comes from.
It's a better experience.
Absolutely.
But, you know, what happened is so much of it became just about the money, that you saw artists, and it really shocks me that Chris Botti has sort of stayed at a level where he'll play the Carolina Theater, because even these PBS artists who have a little more of an artistic bent right away there's a promoter involved who wants to push them into arenas. And we saw a number of those come through at, you know, Wachovia Arena. And you look at how Josh Groban exploded, that they want everybody to be on that level the first time they go on tour. And, you know, that takes venues like us with 1,000 seats out of the mix for those artists who are kind of on the way up. And I really feel like that's starting to swing back. I mean, the fact that, you know, the fact that on the heels of this last special that he did, that we still have Chris Botti coming for two nights, I think speaks volumes about sort of where things are headed these days. And you're going to see a lot of artists who don't want to play to a half-empty larger venue and would rather sell out at 1,000 seats and are going to be willing to work with us. So I feel like our prospects for the future are good. I think the what's going to be available to us is better. And even on the art side, I mean, when we talk about major dance companies or, you know, some of the other acts that may be out there, they're experiencing the same thing. Arts organizations are cutting back everywhere. So what's going to happen is everybody still needs to work. So they're going to have to go out and they're going to have to work for less money. And it just – it opens up the doors to what, you know, what we can bring to Durham, and that's exciting for us.
Absolutely. Well, listen, on the way of going out, why don't you give us the website for the Carolina Theater and all things, as well as your own for your photography, and we'll take the show out on that one.
The Carolina Theater website is carolinatheater.org, not .com. That's Greensboro.
That's right.
We're .org, and we are actually going to be launching a brand new website within the next 2 weeks.
Wonderful. Well, keep me apprised of that, and I'll mention it.
I will. And my website for photography is bobnosek.com. It's bobnosek.com. And thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And mine is claudioarts.com. So if you have any questions about anybody that's been on, or you want to get the podcast, today's podcast should be up by tomorrow or the next day. Good old Ernie Hood of Radio In Vivo will be putting it up for Audrey and myself. And Bob Nocek, I want to thank you. I want to say Nosek, sorry. Checks in the mail. Yes, I know. And thank everybody for tuning us in. This is Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else on WCOM 103.5, signing off. Until next time, cheers.